It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Lesotho's prime minister and deputy to meet in South Africa to discuss recent unrest. Rebel attack repelled in Mogadishu, but the cost of 11 lives. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The prime minister of the tiny southern African kingdom Lesotho, Thomas Thabane, is in South Africa to discuss Saturday's unrest in his country, which he described as an attempted coup. He's to meet with South African President Jacob Zuma and the deputy prime minister of Lesotho, Matajoa Metsing, who Mr. Thabane has accused of orchestrating the unrest. John Romani is a Lesotho radio presenter.
I think all political parties, particularly the coalition parties, should come together and discuss their disputes, discuss their differences, so that at the end of the day, they can bring us peace and tranquility.
A military spokesman said the army was trying to secure the country ahead of a mass anti-government demonstration scheduled today. At least 11 are dead after Somali security forces repelled an attack on a prison housing al-Shabaab militants in Mogadishu. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility. Gunmen stormed the facility after a car bomb exploded outside the main gate. Meanwhile, Somali government forces fighting alongside African Union troops ousted al-Shabaab militants from the southern town of Bulamarr. Brigadier Dick Olam is the Amisom Ugandan contingent commander.
The al-Shabaab really resisted. They fought very hard for it. You can see the tires that they burnt in the city. You can see how they were firing on us from the rooftops. But I'm so sure they've all fled towards Barawe. Of course, you very well know Barawe is my next target. And as soon as I'm through with Bulamarr and Kutunwarre, I'm moving to Barawe.
Military officials said the militants used the town to stage deadly attacks elsewhere in the country. This is VOA News. Malian government negotiators are preparing to sit down with Tuareg separatists today in Algiers, hoping to end violence in the rest of north as the nation tries to regain stability and peace. Since a military coup 2 years ago, Katerina Hoya reports from Bamako.
David Gressley with the UN Stabilization Mission in Mali, the MINUSMA, says he thinks all parties realize they share a common interest in a comprehensive agreement.
It is absolutely essential to have an agreement in the north of Mali. If we want stability, a return of development, to remove the sense of isolation and marginalization that many in the north feel, even those who did not take arms in rebellion.
The first round of discussions were held in July in Algiers. The main issue on the agenda is the status of northern Mali, roughly two-thirds of the country's territory. While the separatist rebel groups have dropped claims for independence and opted for autonomy, it is still not clear what form it could take. A definitive agreement would end 50 years of armed conflict sparked by decades of Tuareg separatist movements. Katerina Hoyet for VOA News in Bamako.
As the Ebola outbreak in West Africa now exceeds 1,500, a U.S. health agency is speeding up clinical trials of a possible vaccine, VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
At the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Anthony Fauci will oversee the trials.
So you want to balance the need to get a potentially effective vaccine to the people who need it as quickly as possible, at the same time that you structure it in a way that you can get some meaningful information as to A, whether it does work or not, and whether it does harm.
If it goes well, the next step is a larger trial in the countries where the outbreak is occurring. But this also has to be done scientifically. Those who get the vaccine have to be monitored. One of the biggest concerns is the lack of infrastructure in the countries where the outbreak is raging. Too few doctors, too little protective gear, not enough treatment centers or medicines to help sick patients. The World Health Organization is asking for $500 million to address these issues. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
The head of Niger's National Assembly, wanted for questioning and suspicion of involvement in a baby trafficking scheme, is reportedly now in Europe. Hama Amadou had left Niger for Burkina Faso Thursday after an arrest warrant was issued. 17 people, including the country's agriculture minister, have been arrested in the case following an investigation into allegations they acquired newborns from Nigeria. A boat carrying at least 100 African migrants capsized off the Libyan coast. The French news agency reported that 15 bodies were found floating at sea, including women and children. Meanwhile, Tunisian officials continue their search for victims of another shipwreck last week. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, September the 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Southern African leaders are holding talks to resolve Lesotho's political crisis.
The one thing, however, that SADC will not tolerate, and South Africa, as well as the African Union, the entire continent, is unconstitutional change of government. We can't have coup d'etats in 2014.
Clisen Moyela is the spokesman for the South African Foreign Ministry. We will take a look at rowdy politics in South Africa. Somalia launches an offensive against Al-Shabaab. Ghanaian education and health officials meet today to formulate Ebola strategy. And residents of Liberia's West Point are happy following the lifting of a 10-day Ebola quarantine.
The people in West Point, the majority, are happy for the fact that they just comfort of the dozens of hardship, the dozens of things in our land, so they are happy.
James Weir is a university student and community leader in West Point, and France calls for United Nations intervention in Libya. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Southern African Development Community, known as SADC, are holding talks in South Africa with political figures from Lesotho to try to resolve that country's political crisis. Gunmen, possibly members of the army, surrounded the residences of Prime Minister Thomas Thabane on Saturday. Mr. Thabane described the unrest as a coup attempt, but military spokesman Major Nledle Ntoy says the military was trying to secure the country before a mass anti-government demonstration that was scheduled for today, Monday.
The command of the Lesotho Defense Force, acting after receiving several intelligence reports that amongst the police service, there are some elements who are actually planning to arm some of the political youth fanatics who were on the verge of wreaking havoc.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called for respect for constitutional order and democratic rule. The United States has also called for a peaceful dialogue and respect for the democratic process in Lesotho. South African Foreign Ministry spokesman Clisen Moyela said there's no place for coup d'etats in Africa.
Because our interest is that political problems have to be resolved through political means, peaceful means, and that means dialogue. The one thing, however, that SADC will not tolerate, and South Africa, as well as the African Union, the entire continent, is unconstitutional change of government. We can't have coup d'etats in 2014. If there are political problems, people must sit and talk.
Residents of Liberia's West Point are jubilating now that the government has lifted a 10-day quarantine of the densely populated borough of the capital, Monrovia. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said the quarantine was necessary to control the spread of the virus, which the World Health Organization says has killed more than 1,350 people in four West African countries. James Weir is a university student and community leader in West Point, and Jatu Harris is a fish marketer and also a resident of West Point. First, Weir tells me that although the residents are happy, they feel the quarantine has stigmatized West Point as an Ebola-infected region. He says the government should give a report declaring they are West Point Ebola-free.
The people in West Point, the majority, are happy for the fact that they just come out of a dozen of hardship, a dozen of being demonized, so they are happy.
Describe for me, what was it like for the people during these 10 days or so when the quarantine was in place?
It was far more difficult for the people of West Point. Difficult in the sense there was no program put into place. Program in terms of catering to the needs of the people. Most of our people were going to bed on wrinkled beds. Our people were being strangulated. People could not move freely. It was unbelievable.
Jatu, welcome to the discussion. I want you to tell me, Jatu, the government has lifted the quarantine. Tell me, how is life for the people in West Point for you?
When a person opens a place, at least we start working for less strength. We are tribulating, yes. If all in the street, all in West Point, everybody was happy. Everybody was happy with us. everybody have become more people get our funding in Western, so Western is Australia or place. So we're too happy. We don't know what to do. So after now, we're still happy.
Mr. Weah, did the government explain to the people why they decided they were going to lift the quarantine?
There was nothing like providing explanation to the people why the quarantine was being lifted. But the government knew very well that she was in error. So because of the pressure on the side of the international partners who saw the faces of the people of West Bend and thought it wise to engage the government, it was against that backdrop. I believe the government was constrained to lift up the quarantine.
I want someone to tell me, either Jatu or you, Mr. Weah, Jatu, have you noticed any more people dying in West Point from Ebola?
As I tell you now, since they closed the Ebola center, we get nobody, even though Ebola is real, but we get nobody who died from Ebola from West Point. Since they closed the road on us, and we said we're taking no death, nobody cried from Ebola from West Point. Even to tell him outside, you don't tell him from outside to bring him inside. And he will tell God, thank you for now. Everybody help you. Now you see me say, I have some more father fat. You see me say, you say, ah, one thing I got to the cross the road on Daniel. I said, we're huge. And you see me with big butt. You don't tell our outside. And they put our outside and they drive more than me. You want to cross the road.
So, Mr. Weah, we can say that in a way that the quarantine worked, did it?
If you say, quarantine was, I would say yes, for the fact that there was allegation being leveled against the people of West Bend regarding everybody being an Ebola suspect. But another thing we want to let the government know, since in fact the quarantine period is over, we are moving freely, let the government come back to the people and let the people know whether or not people from West Bend have Ebola.
James Weah is a university student and community leader in Liberia's West Point. You also heard Jatu Harris, a fish marketer, also a resident of West Point. Ghana is to launch a nationwide Ebola campaign to educate students against the deadly disease after a meeting of health and education professionals scheduled for today, Monday, in the capital, Accra. Deputy Education Minister Samuel Okudzeto Ablakwa says the meeting is necessary to prepare students, parents, as well as all stakeholders to combat the Ebola virus. Ablakwa tells reporter Peter Clotty that discussions at Monday's meeting will include adopting a strategy and other mitigating measures to combat possible Ebola outbreak.
It is true that on Monday we are convening a meeting of all stakeholders at the pre-tertiary level. We have just concluded series of engagements with tertiary institutions, the universities, polytechnics, colleges of education, and we have agreed on a preparedness strategy because Ghana has more than 10,300 foreign students, and we have a lot of students also from countries that are currently fighting this Ebola disease. And what we'll be doing is that we have health experts who will be addressing these stakeholders. We'll take them through identifying the early symptoms, how to prepare the various schools, make sure that they improve on monitoring. If they see signs, what they should do. We would also plan simulation in all regions so that if there is any incidence, how do they manage it and how do they evacuate the student into the closest health facility.
There are concerns that education is simply not enough and that specific measures would have to be implemented to ensure that the students are protected. Now, in this meeting, what are your expectations after these measures are put in place?
Education will be one of the items high on the agenda. We are printing a lot of posters, handbills, leaflets on Ebola. We are also ensuring that the parents of these, because these are children who are under heavy supervision from parents and guardians. The health experts, as I speak to you, are putting together these educational materials, and we will be sharing them with the stakeholders on Monday. And then after, we will go on a full-blown out media educational campaign because we will not be able to have a venue where we can interact with all parents. But through the mass media, we can effectively and efficiently reach out to the parents. And that is what we'll be doing.
After this meeting is done, how prepared do you think both parents and teachers and all stakeholders will be in terms of having better knowledge and understanding about this disease and how they can protect their children, their students, among other issues?
We are confident that after this meeting, looking at the array of experts we have brought together from the public health system, from the president's interministerial task force, which he put together on the Ebola viral disease, we hope that we will really be effective in intensifying the education and making sure that the preparedness measures are put in place.
Samuel Okudzeto-Ablakwa is Ghana's Deputy Education Minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarté from the capital, Accra. It is Monday morning, the first day of September, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Somalia's Al-Shabaab militants say they carry out a car bomb and gun attack against an intelligence headquarters in central Mogadishu on Sunday. The attack came a day after Somali government forces, backed by African Union troops, launched a long and anticipated offensive to take more towns from the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
Residents living around the towns of Galwayne and Bula Marer in the lower Shabelle region were awakened Saturday by heavy gunfire and shelling. Security forces launched a military effort dubbed Operation Indian Ocean to take more ground in southern Somalia with the aim of controlling the strategic port town of Barawe, which has been the financial hub and Al-Shabaab's route used to ship weapons. Lower Shabelle Governor Abdikadir Sidi, speaking to VOA on the phone in Bula Marer, says the militant group put up a real fight to prevent the Somali government from taking over the two towns.
This story is Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda. They tried really to make a resistance. We get some ambush, you know, before winter at Galwayne, early in the morning. After Galwayne, even they tried here to make ambush, they fell it. And when we came here, Bula Marer, we get heavy fighting in front of the town and inside the town and out of the town.
For years, Al-Shabaab has vowed to topple the internationally recognized Somali government. In the recent past, the group has lost ground to AU forces. But the group regularly launches sporadic attacks inside the country and neighbouring countries that has sent its troops to Somalia. Governor Sidi knows the militant group rule the towns with an iron fist and suppress the population.
They refused, you know, even to come here. International NGOs and local NGOs to assist our people to rehabilitate canals and to open their schools and to visit. The visitors cannot come here, Bula Marer, before we capture it here. The civilians, they are very happy now, and they welcome us here.
The military offensive is being conducted as humanitarian organizations and aid workers warn of possible famine like 1 3 years ago that killed more than 250,000 Somalis. In coming days, a political battle awaits Somali officials, and how they approach it could determine the security and stability of the newly liberated towns. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The French government is pressing for the United Nations to intervene in anarchy-struck Libya, arguing that without exceptional support, Libya could fall into chaos and spread terrorism across the region. Some regional powers are already covertly intervening. Jamie Detmer has more for VOA News.
The first mysterious airstrikes came on August the 18th and were followed 4 days later by another sortie. Not that they had much effect. Pro-Islamist militias still seized Tripoli's badly damaged international airport. The airport grab from a pro-government militia from the western mountain town of Zintan served to underline the strength of a coalition of Islamist militias, but the airstrikes were what captured media attention. Libya has no truly functioning air force, so who launched them? US officials tell VOA the warplanes came from the United Arab Emirates and used bases in neighbouring Egypt. The officials insist the Obama administration did not approve the raids, but was aware they were likely to be launched. American officials, who declined to be identified, also say Algeria is among other countries that are playing a secret role in the fighting that has convulsed Libya. Neighbour states are terrified by Libya's collapse into all-out militia warfare between coalitions vying for control and the presence of al-Qaeda-connected jihadists. Diplomats from Egypt, Chad, Tunisia, Algeria and Sudan recently met in Cairo to discuss how to halt the violence in Libya. They've argued that further escalation would require full-scale foreign intervention. From Tobruk, where the Libyan government has moved because Tripoli is too dangerous, philanthropist Hassan Tatanaki, an advisor to the Libyan government, argues the anarchy gripping Libya should not be seen as a local civil war, but as part of a post-Arab Spring struggle for regional mastery between secularists and Islamists. He contends Islamists and jihadists are part of the same movement. Hassan Tatanaki is critical of the Western powers' strategy since the NATO-backed ouster of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi 3 years ago. He says the West was too ready to deal with Libya's Islamists, but now he is fearful of any intervention by Western forces, saying even ordinary Libyans will see that as a colonial move. The UN Security Council has called for a ceasefire, but there are no signs that the militias are ready to stop fighting. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Washington.
The newest party in South Africa's parliament, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, is facing a 2-week suspension after getting into a shouting match with members of the ruling ANC party. Viewer's Anita Power examines the tactics pursued by the EFF and whether they can make a difference in the legislature overwhelmingly controlled by the ANC.
No one expected the Economic Freedom Fighters to behave once they got into South Africa's parliament. The far-left party is led by a man expelled from the ruling ANC for causing trouble within the party and who presided over election rallies full of pumped-up, angry youths. That leader, Julius Malema, has been increasingly vocal in recent months about his former hero, President Jacob Zuma, who was dogged by a corruption scandal. And so, no one was surprised when the party courted danger by getting into a shouting match during a parliament session last week. As a result of that outburst, the party's 25 members may now face a 14-day suspension. The exchange started when Malema asked Mr. Zuma directly when he intended to follow the recommendation of South Africa's anti-corruption czar and pay back government money allegedly used to improve his private homestead, Nkandla. Mr. Zuma responded that he had already answered, which prompted this bout between EFF Chief Whip Floyd Shivambu and Parliament Speaker Baleka Mbete of the ANC.
Can we please be provided with answers, not hiding behind
Honourable
Parliament
Member, that's not a point of order. Please take your seat.
This whole business has predictably drawn the ire of the powerful ANC, which has won every election since 1994. In describing the EFF, ANC parliamentary spokesman Moloto Motapo sounds like an exasperated schoolteacher talking about a class bully, but wants them to behave. And so Parliament will meet on Tuesday to consider whether to suspend the EFF in Parliament. But analyst Aubrey Machinkney says a suspension probably won't change the party's fortunes or its attitude. And he says even if others agree with the EFF, the ANC has such an overwhelming majority in Parliament that it won't add up to much in terms of lawmaking. An EFF spokesman did not respond to calls seeking comment on the controversy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Botswana's Isaac Makwala ran 45.11 seconds to win 400 meters at the IAAF World Challenge Series in Berlin, Germany on Sunday. Ethiopians Mekonnen Gebremedin, Aman Wote, and Kenyan Vincent Kibet secured a 1-2-3 African victory. Ethiopian Mohamed Aman pipped Algerian Taufik Makloufi to triumph in 800 meters, while Ethiopian Tigista Assefa and Kenyan Janeth Jepuskei secured a 1-2 African win in women's 800 meters. In golf, hosts Uganda amassed 18.5 points to win the East Africa Golf Challenge in Entebbe on Sunday. Defending champions Kenya was second ahead of Rwanda. They are followed by Tanzania, Ethiopia and Burundi in that order. In rugby, Namibia overpowered Kenya 52-17 to win the Confederation of African Rugby Under-19 Tier 1A final in Kampala on Saturday. Zimbabwe beat Tunisia 44-26 to finish third, while Uganda beat Madagascar 17-8 to win the Tier 1B contest. Senegal outplayed Zambia 15-0 to place third. Consequently, Tunisia is relegated to Tier B while Uganda promoted to Tier A. In football, the Confederation of African Appeals Board upheld their decision to disqualify Rwanda from the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Cairo, Egypt on Saturday. According to CAF, Rwanda fielded an ineligible player, Dadi Birori, against the Republic of Congo in a Nations Cup qualifier. Birori played for Rwanda's Amavubi and Kinshasa-based club AS Vita, using two passports bearing different names and age. CAF suspends Birori indefinitely from national and club football. Meanwhile, Rwanda Football Federation Secretary General Olivia Mulindahabi claimed in the Kigali media on Sunday that CAF did not apply their rules fairly. He says the Republic of Congo ought to have filed their complaint for 24 hours after their match. Instead, they petitioned CAF 20 days after the encounter. Finally, hosts South Africa edged Cameroon 2-1 in Polokwane to prevail 3-2 on aggregate in their Africa Youth Championship qualifier on Sunday. Although defending champions Egypt edged Republic of Congo 2-1, the Congolese prevailed 3-2 on aggregate. Mali edged Togo 2-1, Zambia dismissed Malawi 3-1, Ghana eliminated Gabon 4-1, and Ivory Coast pipped Libya 4-3 on aggregate. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Our listener mail for this Monday morning comes from Maliki Sise of Accra, Ghana. He says, "Dear VOA, why are we Africans discriminating against each other because of Ebola? This is just an epidemic which will not last for long. If the people of Liberia and Sierra Leone were able to survive more than 10 years of civil wars in their respective countries, I believe they can fight and defeat the Ebola disease." Thank you, Malik Sise of Accra, Ghana, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The Prime Minister of the tiny Southern African Kingdom of Lesotho is in South Africa to discuss recent unrest in his country, which some have described as an attempted coup. Thomas Tabani is to meet with South African President Jacob Zuma and Lesotho's Deputy Prime Minister, who Tabani has accused of orchestrating the arrest. Gunfire rang out on Saturday in Lesotho's capital, Maseru. Gunmen, possibly members of the army, surrounded the residences of the Prime Minister and a top police official, and also disarmed two police stations. An Islamist militia group in Libya says it has taken control of the residential annex of the vacated U.S. embassy in Tripoli a month after American diplomats fled to escape the violent clashes between rival militias in the Libyan capital. News agencies reported Sunday that the Dawn of Libya, an umbrella group for Islamist militia, said it has been in control of the U.S. compound. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington on behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa. Don't miss.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.